This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and we're here with Apollonia Poilane, coming to us from Paris, France. I'm holding up a sort of
eternal loaf.
This is the pillow loaf of the famous iconic Poilane. I call it the country miche. I don't know if that's the right term for it or what you use for it. But this is what it looks like. It weighs about 2 kilos or 4 pounds when you got a loaf. It's people over there. When I was there, people would just buy one and work it off over the next week or so. It lasts quite well. And this is where it all starts for us as bread people. This is the loaf that sort of we know. But there's a whole lot more going on at the boulangerie besides this loaf. Apollonia, we're going to give you a chance to tell your story a little bit of how, you know, your journey to being essentially the proprietress and are you co-owner with your sister still of the bakery?
I am. So my name is Apollonia Poilane, and I am the third generation baker in charge of Poilane Bakery. It was started in 1932 by my grandfather. My father took over in the 70s and structured and developed the company into this extra national company, whether it's because we export or because we've been this year for 20 years in London. But I have also taken over and followed his footsteps this fall 18 years ago. So that is time.
Yeah, it's a long time. It seems like just yesterday to all of us who woke up one morning to this just horrifying headline that your parents had perished in a helicopter crash in France, and that the entire country of France had gone into mourning, and everyone wondered what's going to become of the bakery. And that's where, and yet at the time, if I understand the story correctly, you were had just started studies at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You were over here on this side, right?
Not quite, actually. So I was taking a year off before I went to college. So I was actually working in the bakehouse. Around the time my parents passed away, as you mentioned, in a crash. My father was a passionate and professional grade pilot. I received the news on October 31st that their helicopter had crashed. And the natural thing for me was, well, I will be stepping up and will be in charge of the family's business, because even though it's much, much sooner than what I had planned for, this is where I'm going in life. And this is my life and project and ambition.
And suddenly it was thrust upon you. And yet you still had college waiting. So you had to deal with
being
on both sides of the pond for a number of years.
That's correct.
While also taking the reins of the bakery.
We're in the fall of 2002. I'm taking a year off before I go to college, and my parents pass away in this accident. And there's no question for me of whether I'm taking over the family business or not. This is my calling. This was where I wanted to go in life. I stepped up, and I had about 10 months ahead of me to decide what I was doing with my college admission. And being admitted at Harvard helping very, very much my decision. For 4 years, I commuted between Paris and Boston, taking rounding back on my end of the world, the college and students and friends my cook-in was with him. I would share bread every week when I had my weekly bread delivery. And they would go and visit, and I would take care of my family's business. And in 2007, I graduated with a degree in economics, and I have resumed to a full-time job at the bakery without homework.
Yeah, right, right. But now that you are back, you know, full-time at the bakery and have been, do you get time to actually bake, or are you also mostly running the company?
Yeah. So because once I graduated, I had literally more time to be baking and engaging in other activities and passions to further develop the family's business, but also just, you know, like some of my college mates were engaged in extracurricular activities, sometimes at a professional level. My activity was my bakery. Once college was over, that was time that was freed up to work in the bakehouse. And that's where you'll typically find me on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And I'll do this both to further my practice, but also to develop new recipes. Because I firmly believe that if you want to develop some R&D, if you want to work on new products, you really need to understand how they're going to insert themselves into our reality, our brick oven, using our stone ground flour, using our hand methodologies. And that can't really be done in the lab, where it would be so much time wasting adapting it then to bakehouse that I feel like we might as well work there. So yes, mm-hmm. I still work in the bakery, and I can tell you, it is one of my favorite places.
Yeah.
Even on a warm day where it can be absolutely wretched hot outside, the bakehouse may be steaming hot, but it is a place where you feel enveloped by the heat.
Yeah,
it's the heat that nurtures you. It's the heat that makes you feel at home. And it's no surprise that it has, over the years, developed this environment that favors the production of our breads.
Yeah, like just the natural microorganisms, they probably
exactly
live or happily live in the walls and everywhere.
I think there's some happy organisms down there.
Now, when I had my bakery many years ago, Saturday was always my favorite day too, because it was the day that I could be the head baker, and I could be baking and doing, you know, whatever development work, but also just do the production of the day and not have the distractions of running the business, and
a phone call, not.
Yeah, exactly. So it was the day I always looked forward to. And so I totally get that. And speaking of new products, so you last year came out with this book, at least, mm-hmm. I don't know if this was first written in French, or was this always an English kind of project?
No, it was. So I went to college, and this is where I did a lot of writing work. So writing in English came all the more naturally, that I also wanted to tell the story of the family's bakery in English, because we didn't have an English language book. I had a summer experience where I had kept the bread for over a week, which when I advertised people to eat it within, you know, around 5 days. And so my thought process was, I need to share with the world my admiration at my grandfather and my father's work, at how enthusiastic I can be, having been at that point over 10 years into the family business and or at the head of the family business, but having, you know, essentially worked there all my life, mm-hmm. or having like just like from the crib my parents made for me, which was a converted baker's basket, to my Wednesdays and Saturdays afternoons spent learning how to count in the bakery, or preparing all of the orders, or helping out with the admin. And so all of that just really fueled my desire to share a little slice into what the bakery is like. How does it feel from morning until mid night. And so that's why the book is structured around the morning, the time where I usually work in the bakery, the day, and how to enjoy bread from the crust to the very last crumb. And also how over the years I really developed my outlook on bread, how I see my craft as that crossroads between cereal grains and fermentation, and how that has led me to work on my cornbread, my 100% corn flour breads. And
is that a new
other experimentation?
A product that you brought into the bakery, or was there one there?
Yes. Wow. No, there wasn't. So historically, Poilin works around two grains, wheat and rye. And every time we do it with 100% wheat flour, 100% rye flour. And so when I started, when I was in college, I would have cornbread, and I kept on thinking like, oh, it'd be great to do a cornbread. But looking at the recipes, I would always find that it was half wheat, half corn, which made zero sense to me, because right. For me, a cornbread would be a bread of corn flour. So I was like, okay, I am going to do a 100% corn flour bread.
Wow.
But once you realize that no gluten means like no binding,
right. Then
the challenge came on. And it was 10 years, more or less, not full on working on it, but 10 years between the moment I set that challenge and the moment the bread came out in the bakehouse or in the store, because I wanted to keep the simplicity of the ingredients that we put into our wheat and our rye breads, and have a binder that wouldn't have any ingredients that are less known or less interesting or just less familiar with bread baking. Like from all the gums didn't make sense to me. Or I was just wondering like, what are the long-term effects of eating those? Eggs made zero sense. This is a bread, not a brioche that I'm baking. Sugar, same thing. I'm baking a bread, not sweets. Mm-hmm. So all of those things really shaped, I was going to say façonner, which is the French word, you know, to say that we're shaping the loaf. And it really was the shaping of that thought and the ethos. And it not only helped me develop the recipe, but ultimately also fed my philosophy and understanding of my craft, my outlook on it, and the way I would develop our sourdoughs, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a challenge to take on, to create a cornbread with all corn, 100% corn, you know, no gums, none of the tricks of the trade to kind of hold it together. You know, I'm curious myself, how did you manage that? What is the secret to, and in fact, you weren't even using eggs, so how did you bind it all?
Exactly. So first of all, in my book, Poilin, and it's it was published about a year ago at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Beautiful book.
I have an at-home version that I put in that's adapted from our bakery's recipe, because at the bakery we've developed our own sourdough. So the starting point was, how do we recreate the simplicity of the ingredients of our wheat sourdough loaf? Sourdough, wheat flour, salt, and water. So the compromise came, and of course I'm forced, like, giving you an extreme fast forward view on this, but basically I replaced the water with oat milk. Oat milk and flax seeds bound together create a binding that replaces the effects of gluten. But these are products that are of grains. I have at the bakery, I have a corn sourdough. Salt is salt. corn flour replaces the wheat flour. And instead of water, I have a combination of flax seeds and the oat milk that creates a binding.
That's
so it's a bread, and it's a bread that will keep a little less long than my wheat or my rye sourdough breads. It only keeps for 3-4 days, which is still more than a lot of the white breads or the smaller formats that you can find. But that's my thought process, my starting point was, I want, and the challenge was 100% current flour bread. And the solution was, how do you keep the simplicity of the ingredients that I have in my wheat and my rye breads to stay to the essence of who and what Poilane does?
Yes. Yeah, that's really interesting, because you've got truly not just a, you know, you're not just a bakery, a boulangerie. You stand for something. Poilane has always been at the forefront of, I would say, the artisan revival and the artisan craft of bread making. So can you talk a little bit about, because I want to come back to this cornbread in a little bit, but can you talk a little bit about what that philosophy is and what it is that that are the sort of guiding principles that have allowed Poilane to be the standard bearer?
Yeah. So when my grandfather started in 1932, Poilane was a neighborhood bakery in a neighborhood that was up and coming, where our clients needed something that would feed them and that would keep. And those were the qualities that my grandfather found and offered to our clients at a time where a typical bakery would offer smaller formats and wider breads, mm-hmm. aka the baguettes. Uh-huh. And the thing is, it's a very satisfying bread, but what my grandfather's wheat countryside sourdough loaves offered more was a taste, was a fulfillment, was also just the sheer legacy of one batch to another, because we were using sourdough and not yeast.
Yeah.
My father really structured the business and developed this understanding that bread really is linked to just about anything. And it's important because it means that from the library of books on bread that he collected to the way he developed his training program for his teams, there was intent and understanding that bread was more than something that was just there to feed you. It was there to nurture you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think Poilane stands for this culture of bread, an understanding that bread is not just a food to be looked for subsistence. Mm-hmm. It has to have substance. It has to mm-hmm. have a body to it. And that only comes, and this, well, it comes, first of all, it comes all the more naturally for us that we use sourdough, which is a technique. And I hate when people say, or I don't hate, but I think it's unfortunate when people say, oh, just give me a sourdough bread, because there's so many different types of sourdoughs out there. We yeah. use a piece of dough from one batch, which is a stiff sourdough. And I know you know this, Peter, but I do want to make sure that our audience here understands yeah. what's specific about the Poilane sourdough. It literally is a piece of dough from one batch. We keep aside. We let to ferment to become sour, hence the word sourdough. And it is a technique to start the following batch. And that creates not only a legacy, but creates a specific taste and the promise that when you're going to eat through a slice of my breads or one of my breads, because whether it's rye, wheat, or more recently corn, like these are breads that bear the legacy of generations of loaves, generations of bakers, and generations of Poilanes that have fed and nurtured that ethos.
It's like you're tasting the lineage of that bread from all the way back to its yep. to its origins.
So at the heart of heart, I believe that baking bread is, and of course, you know, working on this book has helped me a lot to decide, like, what is bread? What does it mean to like bake bread? And for me, it's really this crossroads between cereal grains, something that represents a value chain from the guy that sowed seeds, to the person that ground them, to the bakers that baked the loaf, over a year's worth of nurturing from soil to your mouths breads that will feed you. And that promise is something that grains offer and that are sort of the common ground or the simple, very overt thing. But then there's the magic, and the magic comes from the fermentation. Mm-hmm. And the fermentation is the promise that this very simple, very like almost mundane ingredient, even though it represents quite an impressive value chain, is brought to another level. Fermentation is what makes the difference. You know, it's what makes wine, it's what makes cheese, and so many other things that we have on this planet.
Yeah, it's the transformational ingredient.
Exactly. It is the transformation. And when I say it's magic, it's not about the fairies. It's really about the understanding that this is something very special, something that we have an understanding of, but only to some extent. And in the years to come, we'll develop more of our understanding of it. But at the heart of hearts, it is an encounter between all of these worlds. It's not only the grains and the environment, but it's also past, present, towards the future. So it's all of these things.
Well, this is, you know, I could talk all day with you about this aspect of it, because it's.
And we could probably carry on all night as well.
Yeah, true. And we need some good, strong coffee to do that with. But the whole notion of bread as a symbol of transformation is so important to me, as I know it is to you. And before we end this segment, because we want to be able to go into the bakery with you in this next segment, could you talk a little bit about the artwork that's behind you? Because you talked about the culture that Poulain sort of, you know, is protecting and nurturing. And part of that is the culture of art and artists, and you've got these amazing paintings of bread
behind me, right?
Yeah.
So when my grandfather started this neighborhood, Saint-Germain-des-Prés, we're in the left bank in the southern part of Paris, central south. My grandfather had artists, had craftsmen as neighbors, and he started exchanging bread for loaves because, like a lot of the gentrification that happened in the early 20th century in Paris and this neighborhood, people started started not being able to pay for their rent. And my grandfather was starting to bake breads. And so there was sort of this very informal and very familiar thing that happened. And so the back room where I'm in right now is where we have some of the pieces of art that my grandfather exchanged for bread. This tradition has been going on ever since. I have pieces from all over the world, all kinds of media, drawings, paintings, watercolors, sculptures. And all of those really show how art, bread, really fosters the community. And that's, in many ways, my ABCs.
Well, you know, your bread lasts a long time because of that sourdough culture. It gets better each and every day, but for at least a week, and then sometimes longer. But the paintings of bread last even longer than bread. So that was a pretty good trade, I think, that your grandfather made.
It was.
To have some enduring art that keeps that story alive.
Now, the funny thing is, when the artists would exchange bread, what they used to say is that what they liked with our loaves was that once they were done with the painting, they could eat the model.
Sounds like an artist.
but bread really it's no surprise, being such an essential ingredient to our lives, such an essential food, along with wine, cheese. It's no surprise that it's so symbolic, so represented. So yes, it's extraordinary that each of these paintings represents solidly bread, but that also represents how important, how essential bread is.
Do you still have artists that come to you and ask if they could trade art for bread?
Absolutely.
Good.
So I do.
collection grows?
The collection is growing. I, two summers ago, received a beautiful eggshell tempera from Canada. I had, whether it's a watercolor or a ceramics that's right behind me, it's the one that's on the lower side.
Yeah.
That was done by an Austrian artist 6 months ago. So yeah, we do fuel and try and nurture that relationship. And because bread is not only a food for the body, but it's also a food for the mind.
Yeah. I don't know if your camera can catch this, but I think one of the artists that your grandfather did some business with was Salvador Dali, right? There are probably other artists who have since become famous, but he certainly is one of the most recognizable names. And is there any chance that we can see? Is the chandelier still
standing? Yes, the chandelier is still standing, but I did want to warm you guys up for a little bit for this one.
Okay.
So we're in the late 60s. My father is working at the bakery, and he meets Salvador Dali. And the Spanish artists and the Parisian baker get along quite well, to the point that Salvador Dali starts asking my father to make objects made out of bread. So it starts with simple things like a bread frame. Mm-hmm. But then in 1971, he asked my father to make a whole bedroom made out of bread.
Wow.
Now, imagine my father in his early 20s thinking, this guy who's absolutely world famous is asking me to make a whole bedroom made out of bread. My father rose up to the challenge with his team, created a bed, a bedstand, a cabinet, and a bread chandelier that were used in his room at Hotel Meurice. Allegedly, so that he could find out if there were mice in his room. Now, you can go on YouTube and find a really beautiful, beautiful segment of my father and Salvador Dali reading the furniture. But since then, in the back room of the bakery where I'm standing right now, we've had a bread chandelier as a wink to that experience. So I'm going to tilt my camera so you can see it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. So now, for those who are on the podcast that can't see this, if you can, go to pizzaquest.com and bring up this episode, because we're now looking at a chandelier made totally out of bread dough, lit, wired, illuminating the room, created by Leonel Polan for Salvador Dali back in, you said, 1972-ish, around that time?
Yeah, so it was the early 70s. And what happened was my grandfather had a stroke, so he couldn't take care of the business. My father rose up and to the challenge. Salvador Dali comes in and asks my father to make this whole bedroom made out of bread. And since then, we've been doing this bread chandelier in our back room as well. And whenever it runs out of, bread having a life span when it's dough, we redo it every once in a while, and when we redo it, every baker puts their own little touch. And I really insist on this, and I have been insisting on this for the past 18 years as a way of saying this is a living tradition. It's not just an homage, it's something that we're keeping alive the same way we keep our sourdough alive.
Yeah. And it's like an art restoration project when your artists begin to apply their craft to keeping this piece,
going. That's right. Yep.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. We're going to take a little break here. And when we come back with Apollonia, are you going to take us down into the baking area where you can see the ovens?
So when we come back, unfortunately, cannot take you to the bakehouse. We don't have Wi-Fi downstairs.
Oh, okay.
This is as far as I can go, unfortunately. Okay. But I can take you into the bakery you'd like to a little peek.
At least to see, we can see some of the products and the front of the house, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. Stick around for more Pizza Quest after a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We're back with Apollonia Poilin at the Poilin Boulangerie in Paris on the Left Bank. I've opened your beautiful book, which is called Poilin, The Secrets of the World Famous Bread Bakery. But I've opened it up to the page of the cornbread that you were describing in our last segment. And it is just such an exciting looking loaf. It's baked in a rectangular loaf. It's in tight, but you can see the corn. You can almost taste the corn just looking at the photo, and I'm pretty excited about it.
And Peter, that's exactly right. Is when you have a slice of that bread in your hand, or when you have a loaf of that bread, like you can smell the corn, and if you toast it, then you have smells of popcorn.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing with a nice creamy cheese. Well, with some shellfish or even some duck.
So I'm going to try to make some myself with the first chance I get. And I'll either grind the corn myself or get some Anson Mills corn, the corn that they mill, which is some heirloom grains. It's probably just closer to what you're using. And then I'm just going to try to follow this. In the book, there's a sort of a modified version for the home baker made with yeast.
Exactly.
But anyone who knows how to do sourdough cultures could replace that with a corn-based sourdough starter, right? Kind of like what
correct.
So correct. So thanks for inspiring us on that. And I noticed there's also a rice bread in the book. So are you actually making that commercially and selling a rice bread, or is that just for the book?
So we're not. In the book, I shared recipes adapted to the home baker of breads, cookies and pastries that I do at the bakery. I've also, and a large portion of the book is also devoted to what to do with bread. Once you've baked all this bread, what are you going to do with it? How do you make sure that you don't waste a single crumb of it? From when it's its freshest to when it's at its stalest. Mm. Because I really believe in what I call bread cooking, using bread as an ingredient, not only as a food. But I also explain in giving my outlook on bread as that crossroads between cereal grains and fermentation that has fed my R&D and my work. Mm-hmm. So while in the first segment I talked to you guys about the research and development that went into the cornbread, this applies to other grains, and rice being one of the most eaten grains of this planet, along with wheat, along with corn, I thought it would be really interesting to share some of the tests and trials that I do, not only to explain the spirits in which I work, but also to inspire you, reader, listener, experimenter, or just food lover, mm-hmm. of what is bread and what kind of how to look at different grains and what flavors they bring on. So the rice flour bread combines some jasmine rice and some sushi rice for their binding and their flavors, and really works them in more of a pumpernickel-ish style of breads.
Dense, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's another. So, in other words, the book has allowed you to apply your creativity to create breads that you're not even making at the bakery, but just to show and maybe to empower the reader
to create their own
bread.
So what you're saying is true, but not in that order. So it was actually, this book is really about saying, when you come at the bakery, you see breads, you see cookies, you see pastries. And what you see is really the tip of the iceberg of what's going on in the bakehouse. I started a line of cookies with different grains to explain to people that what they see in the store may seem like a shorter line. And it's true. We only have about 15 different types of breads. We only had one cookie at the time and half a dozen pastries. But nowadays we have seven cookies with different grains that are there to show what is the distinctive flavor of different grains, but also to give a sense to my clients of what Poilane stands for and how we work. Because what I realized was, when people come to the bakery, oftentimes out of routine and on either side, clients and us, we tend to like gravitate towards the same, our favorites, our slice of meat sourdough bread that's toasted and slabbed with a little bit of honey for your morning toast, or the little canapes you're going to make out of a slice of my rye bread with, some fish pâtés or whatnot, or a cheese platter for which you'll use my rye and raisin breads, or maybe my corn and hazelnut breads. Mm-hmm. But like, how can I convey all of the work that's happening behind the scenes to my clients? And so all of that has been popping up in the form of products like my cookies, and I have this range of cookies, but the book actually really sort of wants to share with my audience a little bit of what's going on in the bakehouse and just how much creativity goes on. And when a bread like the cornbread comes out, even though it took 10 years for me to put it on my shelf, I know that in time we will better the recipe, and that in maybe a decade or two, I'll have come to something more stable, and that I will be able to, have made that bread more mainstream in people's minds.
Right, because it's an ever evolving process, and
exactly,
and you can always find it. Never seems to be. We always say the quest never really ends. And it's really about being on the quest, and it is about getting to the end of the quest. And it sounds like that's what you've discovered too with your products, is that it's still growing.
It's a quest. It's a journey. When I'm asked about how to bake at home, and bakers are discouraged by their tests and trials, I understand the frustration, but at the same time, what they're not realizing is just how much they're learning, because those mistakes are what is sharpening their eye, their touch, all of their five senses to bake a better loaf the following time. Now, it may happen or not, regardless, you're building this library of experiences, something that we practice when we're doing our apprenticeships as bakers. My father was quite keen on hiring bakers with no experience prior, because he really thought that you really start from a sort of tabula rasa standpoint, which he felt was more, which opened our bakers' hearts, minds, and hands to baking in a way that's much more intuitive, much more close to our five senses. Yeah. And still to this day, it's fascinating to see how we've hired people who've had baking experience, but you can tell that that experience has a very limited advantage. It really comes down to how open are you in your heart, but in your five senses, to how your environment shapes your day and in the bakery, the season, how your dough reacts on a warm, hot summer day or on a cold, rainy day or cold, super dry day in Paris or London, where we've been for 20 years now.
Right. And that's right, in London. And I wanted to talk about it, maybe as you take us through the front of the house and we get to see some of the products in the bakery, talk a little bit about, you know, where and how these products are made, not just in Paris, but outside of Paris and London, everywhere. And, but I would like to say, based on what you told me, the one notion that came to me is if somebody were to ask me, what does Paulhan stand for? What differentiates them from everybody else? I would, to me, what I would say is that it's all about recognizing and evoking the quality of the integrity of the grain. And it's really about showcasing the full potential of what grain can do when transformed into bread.
And the legacy of one generation of bakers to the next, of one loaves to the following one, in nurturing that quest, journey, adventure. Yeah.
Love it. I love it. Well, want to take us through the front? Can we do
I will.
That?
I will. So Will, I'm going to pick up my laptop and show you around.
We'll try to describe for those who are listening on just on the podcast. So we'll describe as we can.
So,
but then you can see us on the video.
Exactly. So right now we're in the back room of the bakery. It is literally the place in which my teams and I normally have breakfast, where we prepare the orders, where we'll have a meeting, in this case, a virtual meeting. But it is this, it's the office in, you know, an early 20th century bakery. Now I'm going to go outside. I'll open the door and I'll switch my thing just because so I don't cover my face in front of you guys and muffle the sound for sanitary purposes. But the bakery is small, so you'll get a quick sense of it.
Great.
You come into the store and there really are, when I will be coming out from the little office, and so we'll be facing the entrance of the bakery. So here we go. And you get a little more art in passing.
Yeah, I see some more.
And this is the door. And here we are into the bakery. You're facing the entrance.
Yeah, we're looking out the big windows onto the street.
Exactly. So we have on either sides of the windows, we display our products, our baked breads, our cookies, our pastries. We also have third-party products, what we call accessories, everything that will facilitate your, you know, eating, keeping, and enjoying of our breads. On this wall, we have all of our products, our breads.
Loads of breads, yes.
Exactly. And on this end, we have all of our accessories. And we have up here the cushions.
There's the little pillow cushions, the new book.
The book and the cushions. I'm just going to show you because it's got the Pinot. You have Peter.
Mine
you have the, really an heirloom.
You have the
I have the freshest batch.
Yeah, beautiful.
All right. Out of courtesy for my clients, please don't hate me for moving back to the back room. To respect their privacy and also to.
A glimpse of the breads, including the two breads that I remember from my visit 20 years ago, you know, were the rye breads and the big round.
And the wheat breads.
Yeah. And then you mentioned cookies. So you have a number of cookies that are out there now as well. And do you do other, anything like pastry type breads?
So we have breads of wheat, breads of rye, breads of corn. We have another family of products, which are the cookies. We have seven grains that we turn into little sablés. This Normandy, where my grandfather was from, textured, sandy textured cookies. And then we have our baker's pastries.
In this country, we call those cookies sandies.
Sandies.
They're like sandies here. Yeah, the pecan sandies, things like that.
So we have another line of products or another family of products we have and carry is what we call baker's pastries. We bake all of our products from bread to cookie to pastry in our wood-fired brick ovens. Now, these are big beasts. And they limit what we can do as far as pastry is done. So we do apple tarts, we do apple turnovers, we do custard cake, and then we do what we call in French un gâteau de voyage. In English, some will call them quick breads. I'm not sure how good a translation is of that because, like, they're for us, they're sweet loaves, they're cakes. And we literally in French call them des cakes, which is a French version of the English words.
Yeah. So all those different products, but you say you still are able to bake them in the wood-fired brick oven?
Exactly.
You don't have any modern deck ovens, gas-fired ovens?
No. So they're all, our brick ovens are these 100-ton heavy brick wood-fired ovens. There's one opening in which we enter in every loaf. The baking sheets of cookies and pastries, everything is baked in those. The heat of these ovens is quite extraordinary. It's very dry. It's super hot. I was about to say steaming hot, but that's not the case. At the entrance of the oven, there's a little bowl in which we put water, which gives the little steam and gives the extra luster to the bread. But those ovens are really beautiful because they really require from the baker to dialogue with what the heat and the weather it is outside. Because of course, you know, they react in a different way. When they cool down, they retract. And when they heat up, they expand. And that's what makes for an interesting heat, an interesting and specific quality of products in the end. Back in the day, and this is the early, I think, late 19th, early 20th century, one of the arguments salespeople would say buy an electrical oven is they were saying it will help the bread retain some of the water in it. So therefore, because most breads were sold by weight, their commercial argument was you'll be able to sell water at the price of bread. And I mention this because it's really important to say different ovens have different qualities and you work and we've developed our baking practice around ours. And yes, it limits our pastry range, but really at the heart of hearts, we are about developing these sourdoughs. And that's our know-how.
Now, in your bakery there in Paris, you can only do so many loaves a day, maybe a few hundred, but your breads are being sold all over and being shipped. So my recollection of when I was there, it was in, I think it was Bièvre, a suburb of Paris, your father had built this manufactory, this big sort of round building with 24, if I get it right, I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly, so correct me, but like 24 individual baking stations, each one to be helmed by a baker. And each baker would be responsible for essentially recreating the same output that the bakers that is working downstairs in your Paris bake shop would do. But basically, so that instead of trying to mass produce the breads by systems, they were all handcrafted the same way as in the mother house, but then exactly. 24 of them. And so all of a sudden, there's like a whole lot of bread.
And 35 years later, it's still the case. So we have four bakeries in Paris. We have one in London. And every our bakeries produce throughout the day so that we can cater to clients' demand, reduce any waste. Outside of Paris, we have 24 of these ovens, same system. And as you said, it allows us to really respond to demand and, you know, up production if we need it, or when it's a slower day, have less bakers, create less, or bake less batches. And that makes for not only like efficiency in terms of the number of loaves we bake, and that's important for wastage purposes. We're not just, you know, just overproducing and then letting it see where it goes and then trying to waste manage. No, we produce to not waste the ingredients and a year's worth of work from the grain to the flour bag, and then, and let alone the baker's work. So that's one thing. And those 24 ovens and manufacture were created by my parents. My mom is an architect and my father as a baker, and both of them really combined their talents and their know-hows to create a place where they could produce a purely artisanal quality and organization, yet allowing them to bake quantities that were significant, that could respond to demand.
It was a genius design. It was designed so beautifully that I still think of it, you know, 20 years later with in wonderment and awe.
Well, it's genius design. It's a craft and a know-how and a way of going about our craft that allows for it. And you know what's the best part about it is that 35 years later, it still works. It's the same method. So that means it's time proven. And, you know, there's so many plants and factories out there that, you know, basically the minute it's finished, a new extension is done, it's obsolete already. This place has been around for 35 years and works.
And it's still going to keep working. I mean, the indelible memory I have of it is in the center of this round building with these 24 stations sort of around the perimeter. In the center, there was this humongous pile of wood, of firewood, that was just built in. And then there was kind of like a claw.
So that's our stock.
That would come down, grab the wood, take it to a chute. The wood would pop out on the other side of the wall to the, in the little individual bakeries where the baker would then gather his wood, stack them and prepare his fire. And every station had this, their chute of wood coming through from this giant pile. It was like Willy Wonka land for breads.
You know? That's absolute 100%. It's a Willy Wonka of bread. And my parents chose the word manufacture because it really represents the fact that our human hands are our main tool. And you know, whether it's Chad Robertson, who called his manufacture in San Francisco, he referred to it. My parents' place was there, in his inspiration.
Exactly.
Pierre Hermé, with his manufacture in Alsace, had the same inspiration. My parents' work, and it's become quite a popular term these days, but I think it's super important just to pause for a second and think, these are our human hands that are doing this.
I remember your father telling me that very thing. And even now, even today in the United States, there's a growing movement called these hands movement. And this is the symbol, it's just a pair of hands with fingers outspread. But he said,
that's the only tool you need when you're baking bread, I guess.
This is the original tool that God gave us. And you know, don't need anything beyond that. Everything else is an embellishment. But and now, of course, what's old is new again. And one of the other sayings that we hear a lot is the future of bread lies in its past. And that refers to fermentation methods, especially.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm glad you're saying this because it also, to me, echoes what my father's philosophy, retro innovation, really speaks to. Having a look at the past and seeing like what were the great things there that were time proven and that still work. Being my father was an avid new technology lover, but he was at the end of the day, it was in his baking practice, it was about finding the best of past and contemporary techniques to nurture tomorrow's sourdough. Not being in this absolute quest of what is the newest technique, trying it, not being afraid of venturing out, but also understanding that, you know, it may or may not be the most optimal thing. Sometimes, as you said, future lies in the past.
Yeah. Well, Abalone, we really appreciate the fact that you are continuing the family lineage, growing it, adding to it, and hopefully you've got another generation behind you that were nurtured the way you were, because, you know, I remember your dad probably grew up as a child in the bakery learning that you did every single part of the operation. And then when the time came, he took it, you know, he took on the reins, and then you have done the same. And all we can say is that we're grateful for that. And we thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge, both at the bakery, in this conversation, in your book, and in ultimately in your breads, which are the transmission of everything you stand for.
Well, as you say, it is a transmission. It's a sharing. It's no surprise that the word kupon is someone with whom you share bread. Mm. But it's also because people like you, Peter, people like the men and women out there who are listening to us, because you guys, because us people are all focusing and or paying attention, listening, and nurturing these traditions, keeping them alive, that we're able to all carry on our crafts. It's a collective work.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And
thank you.
Have you come back. Okay. I'm looking forward to having you again at our Bread Symposium. We're working on, you know, bringing it back. We had to postpone this year's. You were going to be one of our featured speakers. So we're going to have you as a featured speaker in 2021, when we bring it back into our virtual symposium. So unfortunately, we won't be able to fly you over here to do it in person, but we'll bring you over just like we did today. And thank you for everything that you do. And we will look forward to seeing you in the near future.
Likewise, Peter.
And thank all of you for joining us on Pizza Talk today. We're with Apollonia Poulin. And join us on the next episode of Pizza Talk, coming very soon. Thanks. Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.